I've organized the, I tried to sum what questions I saw and what I thought we sort of might have already answered. So what I'd like, of course you're welcome to ask questions from the audience, it's encouraged. So the only condition I have is when we're talking about a topic, don't change the topic. Because we've had enough stochastic walks through space. But what I will do is leave some time at the end for people who have questions. So we'll have a sort of other section if we don't cover something. So that's all I ask. So otherwise, I encourage you to ask questions. So I don't know where to begin. Maybe we should begin with just the first topic up here, negative staining. So, and people, you don't have to ask a question if you want to say something. If you have experience with some of these, then do speak up and add to our panel of experts who are here to encourage your contributions. All right, so we have three questions here on negative stain. I think we can sort of discuss them all at the same time. What is a criterion for good negative staining? And we heard a little bit from about thin negative staining. How do we improve negative staining? And what is the limit of resolution for negative staining? And I think there was a little controversy about that. So let's start with what limits the resolution of negative stain. Which of our panel of experts up here would like to address that? Yeah, Tom.
Yes, Tom. So the common knowledge is that negative staining basically stops around 20 angstrom because of the microcrystals that are formed and cannot penetrate openings smaller than 20 angstroms. And I was actually a firm believer in this until about 2 weeks ago when I was in Göttingen and saw Holger Stork. We should really say something here because he has a 3D reconstruction at 9 angstrom done by negative stain, which I personally thought is impossible. So that shattered my view of the world, I have to say. So maybe you should really say something about this.
We have actually done this just as a test on a graphics treated sample and to see how far we can go, and we recorded 15,000 images of a Gro-EL, Gro-ES complex and just did normal negative stain and then processed them, and you can easily see alpha helices in the complex, and they fit very well to the cryo map. So that's what I
can say. Why is it? Why everybody else doesn't see
Has.
I mean, we have done a lot of negative stain. We have never seen alpha helices. I'm very curious.
But on what complexes? So on which complexes?
On your
uranyl formate. Okay, we use uranyl formate. It's very small, and I think it's the cluster size that limits it. And the cluster size of uranyl formate is, if it's hydrated, it's it's about 6 angstrom, I think. So I think that might be the ultimate limit.
I think David Morgan has something to say.
I was just going to say that in Derosier's lab, when I was there, Cam Owen did a, what was Cam's structure, 11, 12 angstrom helical reconstruction.
I think it was...
In stain.
Yeah, I think we did better. I think you and I did one that went down to about 8. But even though the... And this was a helical structure, as you should tell if you have data, because we can see the layer lines. It wasn't meant to be a jibe or something, Richard. It's ridiculous, right?
One of the other things.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, one of the other things I have always thought about in terms of stain is you're getting something that's very akin, I think, to Shannon sampling, where your stain particles, you know, you have to be able to see something in between a stain particle. And as Holger said, the stain particles are down 4, 5, 6 angstrom resolution. And so if you think about that as limiting your sampling the same way digitization does, you're going to be able to get about twice that resolution. And, yeah. and I think people who've looked for negative stain data on the order of 10 angstroms have found it. Yeah. Most people are like you, Tom, and they just don't think it's there, and they don't bother looking. And you have to look hard, and you don't see it everywhere.
No, there's one difference. So when we do negative staining, by default, we do random conical tilt. And what Holger did was angle reconstitution, so he only uses untilted images, or images of untilted particles. And so all the deformations that you get in Z due to flattening and dehydration, you don't see in projection. So with our approach, random conical tilt, we would never get to 9 angstrom, never ever. And so because we never do angle reconstitution with negative stain, we never saw it. So maybe that's one of the major reasons.
Well, one of the other things I'll say is in our map, we didn't see anything more than you saw at 15 angstroms or 20 angstroms.
Did you see internal structure?
No.
So that's my theory, that you basically see just the surface, and it doesn't penetrate, but it's different from Holger, who actually sees the alpha helices.
Well, if the particles are small enough, they can, what I think what he's saying is they can penetrate the grooves between helices, so maybe you get a bit of contrast, I don't know. But there's another more fundamental problem, is even though in negative stain, if you don't totally dry it out, I think Linda Melanson did... I couldn't find her right there. Did a diffraction pattern, and if you don't dry out the negative stain, you could get diffraction from fibers that go way out. But the issue is that the contrast reverses when you go past somewhere around 8 to 10 angstroms. So there's no way of kind of bridging that. You'd have to do a negative stain map and then something that's equivalent to where you're looking at positive contrast from the protein and not negative contrast from its being whole. So it's possible to do something, but it's not straightforward. Bob had something to add.
Well, just to expand the concepts that can be put on the table, I think whether one gets sub-nanometer resolution or not with a negative stain will depend upon the specimen, and it'll depend upon what kind of negative stain. There's one fact that I'm thinking of. Tom Seska, when he worked with Richard Henderson, looked at negatively stained purple membrane. And with phosphotungstic acid, the electron diffraction spots went to 3 angstroms or something like that. Richard, I don't know if you remember. Whereas with uranyl acetate, it was pretty well trashed down to, 20 angstroms or something like that. So it depends on how the stain interacts with the sample.
Do you think that was positive staining?
I'm going to come to what I think it comes from in the next. If we have a crystal, we know a little bit more confidently what's going on. And so if you have a crystal and the high-resolution features are preserved in the negative stain that you're using, it could well, as a matter of fact, in my early work with uranyl acetate, I got 8 angstroms from catalase. And if you see high-resolution electron diffraction, that's coming from the protein, not from the stain. So it's certainly possible to get high resolution from a negatively stained sample if the protein is preserved.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
I'm just remembering Gervais Moser, who I think reported an 8 angstrom negative stain structure or projection map, perhaps, from something like Molybios permease. I don't remember what it was, but that was my same conclusion, was that it was sort of 20 angstroms for the stain and the rest was from the protein, and that the reversal of contrast would be difficult to unravel.
Can you explain what you mean by not letting the stain dry?
Do you
freeze it?
Linda did that right. We froze it.
Did Holger do that? Can he freeze
it? This must
not
frozen. Oh. Yeah, so...
We did what Mark Adrian did. No, we did the method that Mark Adrian did and Jacques did. With the high concentration negative stain, can he froze it? To try them.
Well, I'm
So I am responsible for the confusion. I say it's very hot. And there are two different techniques for cryonegative staining. There's the one from Mark Adrian and Dubochet, which you were referring to, and then there's the one developed by Holger Stark's group. And the Dubochet method is basically freezing in saturated ammonium molybdate, which is a very high ionic strength solution, and if you're interested in complexes, a lot of complexes will not survive this. And cryonegative staining we usually do for these big complexes. So we're usually not using the Adrian method, which probably is very easy. We just never did it. So we're using Holger Stark's protocol, which we modified a little bit. But what is hard about this is that you have a carbon film, you have your protein solution with glycerol and stain, you put it on the carbon, you put a second carbon film on top of it, and then you freeze it. And so if it's too thin, between the two carbon films, you squash, you really squeeze the particles, they just become a mesh, really ugly, very flat, very dirty. If you make it too thick, then you just don't see through the specimen anymore, you just have it black. And so it takes us probably about 10 grits to get a good one. And if you have to go through the whole procedure, it's a lot of work. And then if you have your good one, it's only a small area that is really useful. And so you try to collect all your data from this little area, and then you have to take tilt pairs, in our case, and taking tilt pairs of a frozen sample is very painful. So we throw away 80% of the images, and so we are left with 20% of the images out of 10 grids that were not useful. And then from these 20%, a lot of the particles are still squashed. So it's a huge amount of work, but the good thing is that the cryonegative stain samples will have much less artifacts, but they still do have artifacts, so you still can end up with flattening and all these problems. So making a nice vitrified specimen is a huge amount easier than doing a really good cryonegative stain sample with Holger Stark's method, but I think Holger might actually be better at this than we are. We really suffer when we do it. So Holger, what is your...
I think we don't have such a low success rate in making them, but it's, I agree completely, it's not easier than making cryogrids, so it's about the same difficulty. We do as well, so, but it was just, I mean, it was an escape route for many of the difficult macromolecules that we could never prepare in cryo, because they were falling apart when you remove the glycerol, and all these difficult biochemical problems that you have when you deal with really large complexes and difficult complexes. So now we can deal with that much better, and we can avoid many of these technical problems of the sample purification and preparation. And since that, we rather go to cryo straightforward, and we also do our cryo, our random conical tilt structures in cryo now, and no longer in negative stain or in cryo negative stain.
So you don't have charging issues, these kind of movement issues, and in cryo area for us doing tilt pairs is really difficult.
Yeah, it is difficult, yeah.
So I pick up the last couple of criteria. Do people have anything to say about good negative stain? How do they pick a good negative stain? Any thoughts on that? Suddenly there's quiet. This one was first. Right, you're second. Wait. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I would like to extend the question of good negative stain. I mean, has any of you experienced problems with random conical tilt and negative stain, so that if you tilt the specimen, then you could get some strange shading at one of the sides of the particle? Or, I mean, has this been experienced? And if so, what can be done about it, according to your experience? Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah.
Your tilt limit has to look identical to your
Does anybody of you have experience with adding detergent, maybe? Does this help sometimes? Small amounts?
So I just want to make a small comment on the negative stain that we do a lot of complexes which inherently have lipid in them, and then a lot of these stains are ruled out because then they are actually destroying the samples. So you can see this, we work with membrane-containing viruses, and for instance, if you use urinal acetate, you often see that you get a lot of destruction of the particles using that.
Do you have a solution?
Yeah, it's called cryo.
Ah, okay. Any other questions on negative staining?
Yeah, can I just, I'll just speak up and say that one of the things I've been doing to address the issue you're talking about was at the suggestion of Ruben Diaz, I've been playing with about a 1% trehalose mixture into the negative stain. Makes the negative stain much thicker, maybe too thick in a lot of places, but it really, you no longer see that very thin stain that piles up on the side. So that might be useful to try. And you don't seem to see any of the effects of the trehalose in terms of bubbling like you do when you're embedding in normal glucose or things like that. I can't say I understand exactly what it's doing.
And this is room temperature?
Yeah, this is.
All right, then. So there were a couple of questions came in on preferred orientation. What can you do? And one suggestion was to add a bit of detergent, which seems to be good for everything. So I think everybody's going to be rushing back to put Ivory soap in there. So there was a question about preferred orientation. How do you deal with it? Any other thoughts about preferred orientation or any particular concerns that I missed when I... Or to eliminate conformational flexibility, does anyone have any good ideas about how to do that? Yeah. Okay, well, that's not that's one suggestion. Work with thermophiles. And I assume you mean not at 90 degrees. Yeah. Yeah, at the back.
No, I was wondering. Oh. I don't think it's a good idea. I don't know whether that can be generalized. I work with a lot of protein coming from aquifers, and there's a lot of conformational heterogeneity. Just coming from the dynamics of the protein itself, I guess it's very much sampling,
but I don't think you can generalize. Well, of course, yeah. That's what I was going to say, yeah. Yeah, it might be interesting.
It is interesting.
In many cases, yeah, it might be interesting. Always, you want to understate everything, because referees jump down your throat if you overstate something. They say, well, they find other... Anyway, okay. Yeah.
The preferred orientations, isn't there also some effect of different glow discharging with different gases that might then give you a different preferred orientation or whatever? I'm not so familiar with it because it never happened to me, but I think other people have.
What about it? Other people tried...
No, in the literature. Wasn't there, yeah. Aren't there cases where people change the atmosphere of their glow discharge and then get a different orientation?
Yeah, there are some nodding heads out there. So.
Just so, for the record, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
A few years ago, we used to treat the grids with polylysing, and that ended up working very well for a specific complex, LIP-XP, and we tested later on others like the 20S protosome. So that was sort of a simple, easy way to see a dramatic change in the orientation. So
that's orientation on the field.
All right. So we have a question for Richard in processing. How do you measure the figure of merit? And secondarily, how do you determine a B factor for your sample? What do you do?
In the pictures I showed, and also on Jose Jesus Fernandez website, out of your normal processing, when you divide your data into two halves and do a Fourier shell correlation, that formula that I put up, which connects the Fourier shell correlation to the correlation between your whole structure and this imagined theoretical structure, C ref equals, you know, whatever, square root of 2fc over 1 plus fc, that C ref is the figure of merit. Because it's the same as the crystallographers use as the mean of the cosine of the phase error. So you just calculate your Fourier shell correlation curve and then apply the formula and you get the figure of merit and then you apply the weight. So it's very simple and you know, you can do it by hand or you can do it by a computer program or you can use Jose Fernandez's website. And then the B factor thing, obviously you have to... You plot the mean of the structure factor in all directions from your 3D structure, and you get a curve. And usually the envelope is very strong, so you get strong diffraction at low resolution, then it fades in a sort of a variety of ways. So you have to kind of exclude the bit, let's say 10 angstroms resolution and lower. So you can't get a B factor if you've only got 10 angstrom resolution. It has to be above that. And then that feeds back exactly to this, you know, what can you get with negative stain? That 10 angstrom business, the envelope function, comes from the envelope of the molecule and the fact that if you change the density of the medium that you're embedding it in, so density matching, if you like, that changes the diffraction at 10 angstroms and lower resolution because of the envelope function. And what negative stain is doing, although it has lumpiness as well, it is actually... it's filling that space, the same space that a homogeneous medium like, let's say, sucrose or glucose would fill. So you have to exclude the bit below 10 angstroms in getting the B factor. And then you know, when you go to higher resolution, depending on how many particles you have, eventually you get to a resolution where there is no signal, or there is still signal, but it's less than the noise. And at that point, your apparent structure factor with resolution becomes a constant. So you can, if you want, just look at it. So you see the low resolution bit coming down, and then there might be a little bit where there's a straight line giving you the B factor, and then it goes horizontal because of the noise. So in the end, you've got a curve, and you don't really know where you are. Where is the 10 angstrom bit? Well, you can see that. Where is the transition from a simple B factor to this constant noise? It's quite difficult. So what we do is we multiply that structure factor average versus resolution. You multiply it by the figure of merit, and that gets rid of the noise or damps it down, and then you get a much more linear B factor. So actually, it is almost automatic. You don't need to think, and that's why it's in a computer program. So, you know, you can either do it by hand, and that's a good idea because then you understand it, but then you can compare it either to the slightly unstreamlined programs that we have, or Jose Fernandez is quite a smooth procedure. And actually, I think... Benoit Zuber just used it a few days ago. So you can ask him, how did he do it when he went onto the website? And I'm not sure, does it involve downloading a program or does it give you the...
Yeah.
You have to download a program.
Yeah. But
and then you run it.
Very easy.
Just a fine point about the figure of merit.
Theoretically, I would think one should use two independent halves of data, the way that Nico was talking about. In practice, will that make a difference on the figure of merit?
So, I mean, you know, I think that's right. I mean, we are using the two halves of the data. It's divided into two halves.
Before you do any reconstruction.
Oh, I see. You mean to get rid of the bias. Yeah, yeah, no, that would be better.
Nico, wanted.
I actually had a question. panel members can ask questions.
I'm sorry.
you have to switch
here.
And that is for Steve, because you mentioned that you also determine a B factor in EMAN, and is this? Are they related or?
So it's not actually too dissimilar from what Richard does. We go through sort of one more step and we determine a one-dimensional structure factor curve, which at low resolution comes from the data itself. So that's how we deal with the low resolution issue. And then at high resolution, it's very much what you'd use in sort of a Guinea plot, but it's sort of derived from solution scattering data and that sort of thing. Anyway, so once you've got this one-dimensional curve, then you just fit all of the data to it in the model. But I would say that very much of the data that we see doesn't really match a Gaussian all that well. I mean, it's kind of Gaussian, and that's what we end up doing. So the B factors that you saw there in the table I had are sort of, you know, the best match of a Gaussian to something that isn't really pure Gaussian, and it's okay because it's not actually used directly for correction. When we would do a correction, we would do it more like, you know, using the FSC curve and turning the signal to noise ratio and doing a Wiener filter, that kind of thing. So,
but you don't normally have a solution scattering curve, do you? For most projects.
That's why I say it's a single synthetic curve, which sort of is, combined with the low resolution curve, so it's just a standard.
Yeah, I guess it was just a clarification on that. So, I mean, Steve, it seemed like from your table that was a per micrograph, and so is this derived from the envelope function for the whole micrograph as part of the CTF determination process?
It is, basically.
But it's not based on individual particles.
No, it's
which is. Yeah,
you're right.
So, I mean, it's your overall decay function, from the micrograph, as opposed to an analysis of the individual particle scattering, and you know how that would compare. Is that correct? And so, I just want to know how similar are those metrics.
That's my question. Yeah. I don't know how similar. A good question. We should figure it. We should find out.
But I guess the B factor that would be determined from the 3D structure would also include imperfections from the image processing.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Well, I have any more thoughts on B factors, B movies? So there's a question here for Steve, but I think it's maybe a little more general. So the question has to do with box size. Sorry, particle exclusion, I beg your pardon. What is a criteria? What are the criteria for excluding particles for reconstruction? And do you reuse them in subsequent iterations? And added to that, I would add the question, if you use a correlation coefficient to exclude particles, are you biasing your data set? So why don't you answer all those questions?
So we don't use correlation coefficient generally as a similarity metric. In EMAN 2, you pick what similarity metric you want to use, and whatever similarity metric you use for classification, well, when you do, sorry, that's actually two different ones. You can use one similarity metric for classification, and then when you make your class averages, because EMAN still uses this concept of class averaging, when you make your class averages, you can pick what similarity metric is used for exclusion of particles. And the way they're excluded is you make the average, and then you compare all the particles to the average with the similarity metric, and you make a histogram, and you throw out the tail of the histogram. Particles are not permanently excluded. They're only thrown out for one iteration, and then they're considered as possible candidates again the next iteration. Did that answer all of them?
Question is, does it bias in a way you don't want reconstruction?
I'm not sure how it would bias it exactly. I mean, yes, there's a possibility. If you use something like correlation coefficient, then the issue is sometimes you can end up excluding your high-resolution particles if they have low overall contrast but good B factors. So then many similarity metrics will say, oh, those are bad particles because they have low contrast, relatively speaking. And so I would say that that method of particle exclusion is really only good for getting rid of things that are contamination or not really particles at all. If you want to use it to get rid of things like particles that are in a slightly different conformational state or something like that, I don't think that's the right way of getting rid of those. I think separating into multiple groups is.
Anyone else? So the question about particle box size, a question was, does it have an impact on model refinement? And how do you pick it? As you go on, do you more tightly mask your boxes? Or I assume that's what it's aimed at. Anyone want to say something about that?
Yeah, I mean, the contrast transfer function displaces the signal away from its original location in the image. And so some of it will, say, move from the edge of a particle into the particle and the other, and also in the opposite direction away from the particles. Correcting the image for the CTF will move some of this information back into the place where it was originally. And so you have to make sure that when you box out your particle, as long as you haven't corrected for the CTF, i.e. face flipping, for example, that you have enough of a margin around the CTF to include all that information. And the margin that is needed can be estimated with sort of a rough diagram where you translate the resolution that you're interested in into a scattering angle and then look over the defocus that you used, how far that scattered beam at this angle goes away from the straight through beam. And that distance tells you roughly how much you have to include as a margin.
Is there a simple formula for that people
can use?
Yeah,
it includes an angle, a defocus, and a resolution, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we know it's a function of those things. Do you have a y equals f of x,
yeah.
1,
yeah.
2, 3, so I got, right?
Very easy, yeah.
Is it written down somewhere so that people...
Yeah, it's probably in that paper.
What I was going to ask is maybe it would be a good idea to ask the person who asked the question, because we might be answering 10 box-sized questions, not the one that was asked.
I assume that the person will say something,
yeah.
Might speak up, and so...
Oh,
Joachim? Here, yeah, please, what was your question?
I didn't turn in a card, I'm sorry. No. I only wanted to say another way of estimating this is simply to compute the point spread function, and that is very delocalized for high defocus, so it sort of wiggles all over the place. And it seems to me easier than the more elaborate procedure that Nico.
Do you need a computer to calculate the point spread function?
Yes.
I don't.
We'll see.
So the equation actually isn't very complicated, and you can plot it out for each spatial frequency. But also, I'd like to bring to your attention a paper by Ken Downing. I don't know if anyone saw this, where he compare the different techniques for correcting the contrast transfer function and how well they restored the displacement of information. And I don't remember the conclusions.
He did have a co-author.
Oh, and Bob was on it too. So maybe Bob should comment on. I think multiplying by the CTF did the best of the three techniques compared, but I'm not sure.
Actually, out of sight, out of mind, I'm afraid. There isn't a great deal of difference between multiplying or phase flipping, but I wish I could remember which was better. It wasn't a great deal of difference.
But we had a lot of discussion about the low angle, data, and in multiplying by the CTF, you make that problem much, much worse. In terms of the amplitude contrast component, you make that much, much worse by multiplying by the CTF. Where maybe the high angle data isn't so severely affected one way or the other. But I would have thought that would produce all kinds of additional artifacts in terms of holes in the center and wrong diameters or field segments and things like that.
Yeah, it's really a good point that how you handle the amplitude correction at low spatial frequency is something I personally don't understand either. But in terms of the high-resolution information that's getting delocalized from the particle, the CTF correction only recovers about half of the information. The other half gets thrown even farther out than it was before. It's the same as the so-called twin-image problem in holography.
In one of Joachim's paper, they tried two different box sizes, one which includes all the delocalized information, one which was tighter, and the tighter one gave a higher resolution. Am I right, Joachim? Or I remember there was something about when the box size is larger, you also include the background noise, which is not the particle.
That's a separate issue. It has to do with measuring resolution. So if you include all the peripheral noise, no? Or the box size for the refinement. I can't remember.
In that paper, we actually did two data sets with two different box sizes. In one case, it was slightly better by using a larger box, an angstrom or less than an angstrom, and the other data set it was worse by an angstrom or around there. And I think the rationale was that maybe you include some more of the delocalized data by using a bigger box, but you're also including more noise in the box at the same time. So it seemed like they roughly offset each other. So I don't know what the final verdict is.
Maybe I'm missing something, but wouldn't you want to correct for the defocus function and then more tightly box?
The way that we generally process things is we create a reconstruction and then we correct for the CTF after the fact.
So rather than picking the particles and doing the refinement that way, correcting out, the particles themselves, we correct the averages or correct the, after they're significantly enhanced by averaging, and then that's the way we correct it.
Correct the reconstruction.
Reconstruction, right? Yeah.
How do you do that if you have a range of defocus?
You do defocus groups. You correct.
Oh,
the
I see. Okay.
Is there any advantage in doing that? Well, it's a lot stronger signal. But it's all additive.
It assumes your defocuses are very tightly grouped.
Yeah. Sort them very tightly. We use a thin carbon under our sample so we can see the
But is there an advantage in correcting on the 3D instead of correcting on the environment?
We don't filter differential signal to noise.
No.
Yeah,
Sure, we can discuss.
What do we do? Do we correct the individual images where the signal to noise is
0.1?
So somebody write a Wiener filter, and we see that if the or draw the function. If you're trying to correct the low resolution information in order to get a good profile of radial density profile, then you need to have a real correction for the CTF. And if the signal to noise ratio is 0.1, then the Wiener filter doesn't look anything like the real CTF function, especially at low resolution. So this idea of averaging everything together so that your signal to noise ratio is reasonable, then you can really do a proper
correction. So I think the way the math works out is the optimal solution is to do a signal to noise ratio weight when you do the averaging and then do a final Wiener filter in the end whenever you do the averaging. If you make class averages, then you can do the CTF correction on the class average. If you do it in 3D, you can do it in 3D, but the Wiener filter obviously has to happen as the step when you're averaging, right? Because otherwise the signal to noise ratio isn't right. But you want to do a signal to noise ratio weighting when you're combining things as well.
But that doesn't help with the delocalization for the box.
No, that's the phase flipping issue. Yeah, you have to be careful when you do your masking and how big your masks are and how big your box sizes are. But when you phase flip, you shouldn't mask.
Yeah, I mean, one procedure would be to box your particle, phase flip or multiply by the CTF, then you mask, then you do all your reconstruction, and then at the end you may do an amplitude correction which involves the Wiener filter.
Everybody happy? All gonna... quick question, what limits ribosome resolution? Bad luck?
You don't even want to give me the microphone.
Wait a minute. Maybe I know it's a sad story. Maybe.
Well, I wish I knew. I agree with what Steve was saying. It is really a matter of data collection and whittle the data down so that you get you sort of master the conformational heterogeneity, and it might be very tough. So we've been looking for specimens that seem to be very stable. Particular ones are advantages, so we're sort of plotting ahead. But it's really not a routine thing. I mean, if we ever get to atomic resolution, which I hope is going to be very soon, because I promised it my grant application, then it's still not going to be routine. Okay.
Any other thoughts about? Do you mean good particles or? Other comments?
So when you say you see the tone rings, do you see them after averaging the particles? I mean, power spectra of the particles that you picked, or is it the carbon film?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you see carbon film, it'll be fine. If you have carbon
film, the tone rings. When do you observe them? From images that have carbon film? Yeah. So you observed them from just from ice with particles. So in that case, I would say tone rings don't necessarily indicate how far your data will go once you've processed a number of particles, because we never observed tone rings beyond 6 angstroms for the rotavirus data, and it still went to something like 4 angstroms. So I think that's obviously is very reassuring to see the tone rings, but I'm not sure if that indicates the limit of the resolution that you can obtain.
Could this discrepancy have to do with the size of the particle, that the rotavirus is much larger than the TMV? And so that the defocus difference between the top and the bottom is quite large?
Absolutely. So the biggest point is that because of the size of the particle, if you have focus gradient, for certain particles, there's no way you will see 3 angstroms because there's a gradient. The average, then you have a similar effect. And tolerance will not show up.
At 300 kilovolts, do you think that the tone rings fade out at 6 angstroms for a 700 angstrom particle?
I don't remember.
Yeah, but I remember. I remember it. No, it's at higher resolution.
It's at higher resolution. Yeah. Okay, I'm glad somebody remembers. Yeah, I just failed it. It's a test. Somebody said. Let's see. So the 3D reconstruction algorithms, there are a bunch of them. And the question is, how do you know which one to trust? Should you use, back projection? Should you use Freeline? Which is a completely different algorithm. Should you use CERT or one of those iterative reconstruction algorithms? So has anyone compared all of them? People have told me that these iterative ones are better.
Paula published a paper on that.
Okay. Is it theoretically better? David is asking. Is one of the methods theoretically better? Yes. And
almost always iterative algorithms yield much better results, but most of them are impractical. Sophisticated direct Fourier inversion is very good. Like grading algorithms like publish and so on, but I never figured how to put severe correction and so on.
But everything is better than back projection, right?
Well, it depends.
You
have
to read the paper.
Back projection has a problem when you have regions which have very few Fourier components, okay? Then the error is very large because it's just divided by the number of Fourier components that you have encountered, and it doesn't compensate for it in an intelligent way.
Just a quick note, I'm sure many people appreciate this, is that, for example, taking these iterative algorithms like, you know, SART and SIRT and whatnot, that you can get tremendous speed-ups on GPUs using these. And so, I mean, we've gotten, you know, 100x kinds of performance benefits by going to GPUs for these. And so that may bring it, especially with GPU clusters, in the realm of what becomes practical for single particle work.
I would just say that, I mean, I think to sum up what Powell's conclusion was and wasn't, that in most cases, I mean, if you have reasonable uniform distribution of orientations, the differences between CERT and direct Fourier inversion, which is much, much, much faster, are negligible. I mean, they're really not very different.
Has anyone tried just straight Fourier inversion of the set of equations? It's a least square solution. Is that the best you can do, or does CERT do better than that? Well, until recently, some of the virus reconstruction algorithms used inversion, but they used tricks to. You throw out data, so you insert your planes at an angle, and you don't use all the data on the plane, so you lose a certain amount of data, but. Okay, are there other comments about, for, Andy?
It was a little comment in my small world that you do a reconstruction, you want to get the right result. So when you get people say, so either something is wrong and the other one is right, or what differences mean in place.
What kinds of differences?
What he just talked about.
I mean, do you have a specific example to? Other thoughts? So I had a thought to ask a question that has to do with how do you know your reconstruction is right? And I was thinking particularly about Fred's presentation, and the answer is why can't we do a goodness of fit I mean, you have a set of observations, and you have a model. So you have your model, and you have some kind of matrix that takes these observations and produces a model. That's what you have. And assuming you don't have squared terms from your observations linear, you can ask the, or even if it's, maybe if it's not, why can't you do a sort of chi-squared test by subtracting the reprojected model data and simply, so you'd have something like a model minus observations squared, model times some your matrix inverse, something like it's squared and divided by, you know, sort of your estimate of that. Why can't you use that? I mean, this then incorporates everything you have, the orientation parameters, what you think the CTF is, what you think the amplitude contrast is, and just ask if you ever get anywhere near, you know, something that's believable, is that a useful idea or not? It's just something to talk about. So Bob's hand shot up first, so before I even finished writing the equation down. So
I first want to ask a question and make sure that my comment, nonsense.
My question is, what you're proposing, is it that just a measurement of how consistent the model is with the data?
Yeah.
Right, right. So if that's the case, and David wants to object, but let me rush forward. By overinterpreting the data, I can reduce that inconsistency to zero, but it doesn't mean I'm getting the right answer.
No, I think if you practice it with purely noise images, you won't. I don't think it'll work.
But it certainly won't go to zero, for sure.
Well, no, yeah. I exaggerate.
But the question, yeah.
First time in my life I ever exaggerated.
I mean, let me just say the way I was thinking about it is, you know, you have usually you fit a straight line, so you have some data points like this. And, you know, so you have some straight line fit, and you can get you want to get the intercept and the slope, you get some measure. Now, it turns out if you have a trillion points and you find out that they all look like this, I was trying to make it come down like this so that you have error bars that are here. The errors from this, certainly the straight line is not doing well because you have a lot of measurements of the error here. So when you actually do the discrepancies, this thing will fail. The idea I had the back of my head was it does more than just sort of get consistency. It really looks at whether the errors from this huge data set really are explained by your model.
David,
yeah.
It meets the same objections that I raised before because here you really assume that you put the data into the right spot in terms of the whole geometry.
It tests everything.
How can it do it?
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
You put Fourier planes somewhere and you got them somewhere, you know, from angular reconstitution or whatever.
Yeah,
and then you reproject, and then you get perfect fits.
Right, so, but I agree with Nico that the data in different tilts are correlated, so you don't have total freedom to do that because there's correlation. If you have two planes that are close together, yeah, the data as you go out are correlated. Sure, when you get way out, they're not, but you have... I see.
It's exactly, you know, I mean, it doesn't matter whether it's chi-squared or a linear metric. And so it doesn't, the whole issue of overfitting the data is still very much an issue with that metric. So it's a necessary but not sufficient metric in terms of estimating what the errors are in the model, because there's no aspect uniqueness of the model in terms of fitting the data that corresponds to that. So there can be many, many models that will give you the same distribution. And so it does not give you, it doesn't have the self-validation that you get
So I haven't fully thought this out, but isn't there some number of projections if one assumes an evenly spaced data set that one needs for a certain resolution to?
Yes.
And couldn't one have that kind of thought go into this as well to decide if the fit is unique versus you know some preferred orientations that will not determine the reconstruction uniquely?
Well, let me put it this way. Suppose you did Richard's tilt experiment with what Nico says, and then you turned around and insisted that not just that you get the right angle, but that you can actually explain the image.
Yeah. The R factor, which is now asking what's the predictive ability of your model to predict data that wasn't used in the process. Yeah. This is simply an R factor,
yeah.
Which is just how well you've explained the variance in your data. Right?
So if you collected a tilted data set, so would you do better with Richards if you assumed the angle was about right and asked how well?
So
I mean, there.
My
every observation, if you make two observations, you can then do a much better job
yeah.
of determining
yeah.
the patient. So wherever you can, you should probably do that.
Okay. So I was just wondering if, say, if you, after determining the orientations and plotting them with Steve's nice program, you see that you've basically sampled very densely all possible orientations. And then you do this fitting or R factor calculation, is it still possible that this is just one of many solutions? If it's very densely sampled and should.
I think so. I don't think densely sampled means correctly sampled.
Because you get the alignments wrong and you're screwed. I mean, yeah. Very well to your bad alignments.
I mean, if you had random alignments, right? I mean,
but would they all fit together into a 3D structure? I mean, wasn't there some?
Well,
I remember you talked about this a long time ago when you worked on viruses. There was this whole discussion about how many views does one need in order to uniquely calculate a 3D structure.
I-D-O-D.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
And so I was, and of course that's sort of a slightly different question, but it seems to me it's sort of related to this one.
Yeah, it is. That's what brought it to mind in a way was that. You do have this constraint. So if you did the tilts, if one pair isn't enough, you would need to do sort of pi d over d tilts.
Now, can I go back to the suggestion? I think it's an extremely good suggestion, actually. And if people could think about it and do it and try it, you know, you'd get quite a bit further. I think it's equivalent to saying that you take all your raw images and then you take your 3D model that you believe is consistent with all your data, and then you take the particular angles that you believe, you know, the images were used to make the 3D model, and then you recreate the projection with the CTF and the, you know, everything exactly correct. So you have your raw image, very noisy, and then you have from your 3D model the bit of that raw image that represents the signal, and then you subtract that from the raw image, and you should be left with completely pure noise with the same spectral frequency, the same power, and that's actually your formula.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So, and I don't think anybody's done that, but I know Pavel thinks about this, but I'm not sure if he, you know. but anyway, if you did that, I do not think that with people's normal data that it would be true that you'd be
yeah.
left only with the noise. You'd be left with quite a bit more then you know, so you've explained some of the observation, but not all of it. So I think it's a good idea to have this. Now, the X-ray people do this already. That's their R factor, as David was saying. And the R factors are not equal to the error level in the measurement of the data. In protein crystallography, you get normally 5% error. You know, the error bar over the average is about 5%. The R factors are about 20%. That means your model doesn't agree with your observations by a significantly bigger amount than the error, three or fourfold. And then they also do the free R factor. That's to eliminate the kind of model bias. And they always quote R factor and free R factor. Normally it's 20% and 25%. And then the real error is down at 5%. And a lot of the people in X-ray are trying to get the 20s and the 25s down to 5. And it's all to do with multiple models, solvent, all that, a lot of things that aren't understood. We're not even trying to do this at the moment. And I think we should. I think it's a good suggestion. You'd probably get, you know, when you subtract the back projected and CDF corrected 3D model from your raw images, you'd probably find there is something left there. And it'd probably be a bit higher. It might be 20% higher. Or if you've really overfitted it, it might actually be a bit lower. But it would be a good thing to do, and you could do it for both the data and for other things, you know, say a tilt pair that you've taken out of it. So I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I sort of agree, but I just want to point out that that whole test is very sensitive to all the different effects that Powell is talking about, the reconstruction artifact. And this doesn't seem to be a perfect reconstruction algorithm. So it's sort of very, in practice, it's very difficult to do what you suggest.
I think what he meant is difficult to interpret for all the factors in this matrix here, which ones matter. Yeah. No, I know. We don't.
To argue about it
yeah.
Because no one's done it.
I've done it.
That's it.
Okay.
I did it for the purposes of trying to extract parts of the data. So you take the whole particle and you remove a subunit from the model and then you try and subtract it out so you can get just that subunit out. And demonstrated that you get reconstructions that way, but you're absolutely right, there's a shadow always. And you can't get rid of the shadow completely. And I don't have a number for you either.
That should be
but
our
it's
goal for the next meeting.
Yeah.
Remove the shadow.
Yeah. Remove the shadow.
The cloud that hangs over the field.
The shadow knows, right? There's an old radio program.
I would say the shadow was very useful, though. I mean, you know, it looked very much like what you would expect if there's, you know, slight alignment errors and everywhere and stuff like that. It was, you know, I think that's probably right.
Yeah. But one could do the calculation, you know, say from 10x or so on, or whatever, you know, or the first, you know, from the peak on, is a way of minimizing that effect. Right.
Well, are there any other issues people would like to talk about that you may have sent up questions that, in my haste to put them up in the start of this, I didn't get a chance to do it, or questions that have occurred to you.
I have one here.
Yes.
I would throw this at everybody. Recently, I have been showing my map to a number of developers. They told me that there is a possibility that electromagnetosity can resolve things that don't face around it, that is, the hydrogen. The reason being that X-ray, that would be, I mean, X-ray to the potential speed measurement.
Well, in neutron diffraction, you can see them pretty well.
It's all in Nico's paper. You know, with, of course, co-authors. But no, what Nico did was to... The thing is that these cross-sections are not actually known very accurately in the range from, say, 3 angstroms to infinity for electron cross-sections. They are accurately known for X-ray, and they are accurately known by theory for free atoms in the free atom. But when you make molecules out of atoms, all the electron orbitals shrink. And then there are various theories about molecular orbitals, which are not so clear and not so accurate. So what Nico did was to, rather than picking a particular theory and putting in hydrogen and so on, he actually had, I think it was 13 types of atom structure. So CH3 was one, CH2 was another. And then the idea was you would refine those occupancies or, you know, scattering factors against the data. And the idea was that with 10 or 20,000 reflections, 13 parameters would be enough. And it sort of came out right. In other words, the hydrogens do scatter more. So the ratio of hydrogen, say, to, well, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen is something like 6, 7, 8 for electrons, but it's more like 4. And actually, that's more or less good enough. So you don't really... In fact, most people who do refinement of electron diffraction data, say, 2D crystals, they don't even bother changing the form factors. They just use the old X-ray ones, which are not quite right. It doesn't seem to matter too much. In fact, I think Nico, it was about 0.5% off the R factor from using proper form factors rather than just X-ray ones. So at the resolutions we're at, it doesn't matter too much because, you know, a benzene ring is a sort of blob, and it doesn't matter if it's a blob with slightly stronger hydrogens on it or slightly less strong hydrogens on it. So I think it's an issue useful to understand, but probably isn't terribly, you know, it doesn't make a big difference.
I also remember that there was a discussion about detecting charge, and I was wondering, I mean, my impression was always that this cannot easily be done because, you know, the free atom calculation shows a huge increase in scattering at low resolution, either positive or negative, depending on the charge, but that inside a protein, those charges would never be free. Truly, because of polarization around them and things making, bonds or whatever. So, what is the thinking about this?
Can you see charge? Only if it's on your carbon film.
3 angstrom resolution.
Can I say something? So, the original thing about charge, I think a lot of people discussed it. The only paper was Yoshi's paper, about 1997 or so. And they claimed that they could see the charge difference on the aspartic acids, which ones were charged, which ones were uncharged. We now know that those differences are due to the side chains falling off because of radiation damage, which you did not know then. So I think actually the charge is, I agree with you, it's going to be a very minor modulation, and no one's detected it at all in any real case. Whereas they have detected in X-ray and EM side chains falling off, so that, you know, it'll be probably few percent of the level and quite difficult to detect. But if somebody could, it would be quite interesting.
The charge is going to be much easier to detect at low ionic strength. I mean, at physiological ionic strength, the charge is very strongly screened, and so you don't get much scattering from that.
Now that we come to this important point, we can either have more questions or wine and beer. Now, I don't want to discourage anybody from asking a question, but I thought I'd just let you know that you can also approach these people at wine and beer and ask them any other burning questions you have. So, why don't we just gracefully depart to the bar and ask our questions there? But I'd like to thank all the people. all of you for contributing.